Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the extra jeopardy the United States finds itself in, with not just a president who is delusional and operates according to his own belief system, but the National Security Council that is meant to provide Trump with real-world information and intelligence is also operating in an alternative universe, tailoring its own reality, with NSC advisor General Flynn reportedly rewriting the presidential daily briefs. Ali Watkins, who covers national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News, joins us to discuss the bizarre claim that Trump made to a military audience at CENTCOM headquarters in Florida that, quote, "The very dishonest press have not reported terrorist incidents, and what kind of information and from what sources is intelligence being fed to Trump about what is happening in the real world?" Then Jacob Halbron, a senior editor at The National Interest and author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, joins us to examine reports that the number two job at the State Department is about to be filled by Elliot Abrams, who is considered neocon royalty. If today's meeting with Trump goes well for Abrams, then his nomination will be a clear repudiation of everything that Donald Trump said on the campaign trail about the disastrous Bush-Cheney Middle East misadventures. And since this former Reagan administration and George W. Bush administration official was so scathing in his criticism of Trump in his role as advisor to Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, Abrams' closeness to Netanyahu and Jared Kushner and his hawkish stance in favor of a war with Iran would indicate the reasons why Abraham got the job. Then finally, we will look into the recent U.S. raid in Yemen against AQAP, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, that the Trump White House is claiming as a great success, although the evidence presented by the Pentagon of a captured al-Qaeda video turned out to be a decade old and available online. An expert on Yemen, Sheila Carapico, a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond and author of Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf, joins us. And joining us now is Ali Watkins, who's a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News and previously covered national security for the Huffington Post and McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Watkins.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And it's one thing for the president himself to operate in an alternative universe and have his own belief system, but it gets really scary when the National Security Council, which is supposed to provide him with real-world intelligence, is also inhabited by people that seem to have their own facts. And there are recent reports now that General Michael Flynn, the National Security Advisor, is editing the presidential daily briefs before the president himself sees them. So what's your understanding? What are you hearing from your national security sources?
Well, I think the first thing I'll say is that as far as an understanding of how the NSC is working right now, I don't know that there is any understanding outside of the White House itself, which is obviously very concerning for a lot of reasons, some of which you mentioned, that the personalities that we know are involved in NSC are obviously controversial, to say the least. I think it's worth stating that obviously this is a presidential transition. With any presidential transition, there is shuffling, there is, you know, people jabbing elbows, whatever. But the level of kind of theater of the absurd that we've reached as far as the NSC goes has been, you know, expedited in the course of these 3 weeks. We've obviously seen kind of a reshuffling of the National Security Council, putting a much more prominent role out there for Steve Bannon, who is not, you know, he obviously occupies a policy advisor role to the president, which is not necessarily a national security role. So the fact that he's now a prominent member of the NSC is certainly a change. We have Michael Flynn, who himself is obviously a very controversial figure in the national security world ever since he's left DIA and kind of joined the Trump camp. So as far as what we're hearing around town right now, I think one of the most alarming things for people in national security circles right now is the kind of the insular nature of NSC, which obviously the Obama White House was by no means a pillar of transparency, But we've seen this kind of strange power grab for certain personalities in the NSC, including Bannon, that is kind of indicative of where the NSC might go just as far as consolidating power. And you have these personalities who are stepping up and driving this NSC train, essentially. And the examples of Flynn kind of truncating the PDV and Bannon really kind of sticking his foot through that door are two big examples that I think are alarming a lot of national security circles here.
And Ali Watkins, what do you think is going on with the president himself? He spoke at CENTCOM, which has jurisdiction or operational control over the Middle East for the U.S. military. And he said, I quote him, "You have seen what happened in Paris and Nice. All over Europe, it's happening. It's gotten to the point where it's not even being reported. And in many cases, the very, very dishonest press doesn't want to report it. They have their reasons, and you understand that." Now, he's referring to all of the military personnel he's addressing. That in itself is a very scary assumption, that somehow there is an alternative universe where the press are a bunch of liars and you stalwart folks in the military know the truth, when in fact what the president said was utterly absurd. And he subsequently, the White House has come up with a list of 78 terrorist attacks, all of which were covered thoroughly by the press, both here in the United States and abroad.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the most absurd things about Trump's address to CENTCOM is that military addresses are not hard. There's a pretty basic formula for how a president addresses the military, especially in a setting like this. And when we've seen repeatedly now that he kind of, for whatever reason, he hasn't made that kind of code switch yet from stepping out of campaigning. You know, we obviously saw this drumbeat of the lying press, the dishonest press all throughout the campaign. And he's clearly continuing to latch on to that despite having won the election. And as far as these examples that he cited, you said yourself, it was absolutely absurd, some of these terror attacks that he cited in this list, because the list was no doubt compiled off of press reports of the media reporting on some of these attacks. So the fact that he's continuing to spew campaign rhetoric at a lot of these national security appearances, including the CIA appearance that obviously happened right after his inauguration, is, I think, for a lot of national security intelligence types in Washington, raising concern that he hasn't really stepped out of that campaign persona yet, and he still lacks the ability to, at the very least, articulate a further understanding of national security policy. And when and if we ever see that switch from him, I think, remains to be seen. But as this has continued over the last few weeks, I don't think people are very optimistic.
And again, I'm speaking with Ali Watkins, who's a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News and previously covered national security for the Huffington Post and McClatchy Newspapers' D.C. Bureau. But the only conclusion one can come to is that by saying stuff that is completely untrue and accusing the press of lying, I suspect, and I think many people have indicated this to be true, that as far as Trump's constituency, the roughly one-third of Americans who voted for him, they already believe that the press is dishonest and they believe Trump over the press. So to that extent, I guess you could say he's preaching to the choir. But there seems to be another motive here, surely, and that is that the Trump White House is attacking the only people who can hold him accountable, given the fact that the Democratic Party doesn't seem to be able to stop the Republicans on Capitol Hill. They don't have a lot of power and a lot of credibility at the moment. So is that what's going on here, that this is an attempt to basically, and given that Bannon himself has said the press is the real opposition, not the Democratic Party, that would indicate to me that they're really trying to stop the very, what they consider to be the real opposition from holding them accountable.
Yeah, I mean, you've seen this very concerted, directed effort. I mean, if there's one messaging line that has stuck since Trump first really announced his candidacy, it's been the lying media, the dishonest media, the slanted press, fake news. So I think in a lot of ways, I mean, Trump obviously has this very complicated relationship with the media, but when you're looking at a Bannon or even a Flynn, really, there is a very almost preemptive, very strategic preemptive move that I think you've seen over the last few weeks, especially, of delegitimizing the press before it becomes an even bigger problem. Whether or not they're going to succeed in that ultimately, obviously as a member of the press, I don't think they will. And I think it's really become a watershed moment for journalists to kind of really feel repurposed in what our job really is in this one. But I think the question really is with the public at this point, is at what point do they realize that the media industry, the journalism in general, is not a political agency? You know, we're called the fourth estate for a reason, in that we don't align with the other three branches of government, that we're a separate watchdog. And I think the question that remains now is, at what point does the public start to re-understand that role? But I think when you talk about the Bannon argument of the opposition party, it's really a very prescient move on his part, because it effectively serves the dual purpose of attempting to delegitimize the press and also label the press as a political entity, which for a lot of the public that already distrusts the media, you know, really speaks to them. Calling the press politicized kind of validates some of their concern with it. So as far as delegitimizing the media goes, I think it's pretty clear that it's a very preemptive move, and that there are some people around Trump who are very smart about doing this and know how to kind of wage a very functional war against the media.
So, Ali Watkins, what do you make then of this lingering story about Russian influence over the elections and Trump's alleged ties to Russian oligarchs and to Putin himself? There, of course, was the famous dossier from Christopher Steele that wasn't meant to go public, but it did, and he's gone into hiding. And there's also been a rash of arrests and murders of top FSB officials in Moscow, one, of course, being the former KGB general and FSB general who was the liaison between Igor Sechin, the head of Rosneft, a close friend and a former KGB colleague of Putin's. He runs the National Oil Company, and the liaison between Sechin and Putin was murdered on Boxing Day. And found in the backseat of his black Lexus. So, and there have been a couple of other very high prominent arrests of senior FSB officials and people from the Kaspersky cyber lab. So, and some people are making the connection and the coincidence that this roll-up of the CIA's top spies inside of Russia itself coincides with when the Trump administration started getting intelligence briefings. So, there's a lot of smoke there, obviously, and there's been for some time. What's your sense of where that is heading? Are those investigations, particularly the one under jurisdiction of Senator Burr on the Senate Intelligence Committee, are they going anywhere? Because Politico was reporting a couple of days ago that Pence and Ryan and McConnell are doing everything they can to quash those investigations into ties between the Kremlin and the Trump campaign.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the Russia-Trump story is kind of the lingering cloud hanging over this right now, and we've all kind of been distracted by the frenzy of the NSC and the White House and some of these juicier, colorful stories of NSC. But I think, in short, the Russia-Trump story is not going away, and in large part because of so many of these investigations happening on the Hill. The point about Ryan and McConnell, this is where I think you're going to really eventually have to see push come to shove as far as where the GOP is going to fall on both Trump and the Russia issue, which are linked in some aspects and also separate in some aspects. So as far as Burr's investigation on the Intelligence Committee, it's almost palpable here, and I'm actually sitting outside the Intelligence Committee right now. It's almost palpable here when you bring up Russia Democrats on the Intelligence Committee have been insistent on this probe. And Republicans, too, on this committee have not been opposed to it. You know, McConnell has limited influence on this panel. And you also have Burr, who is not, it was said he's not running again. So Burr has kind of been, he obviously stood by Trump throughout the election, but he's going to be in a very powerful position over the next few months as this investigation continues, a powerful and, you know, possibly tenuous position depending on which powers start yanking him in certain directions on this probe. So the investigation on the Senate Intel side has started. I know there were a couple details that needed to be worked out as far as a lot of this information is obviously highly compartmented and can only be seen by certain people with certain clearances. But that investigation is rolling. And I know they would like to have it moving and start putting out things next few weeks, which is probably optimistic. But there is this kind of energy in the Senate, especially, that I don't think you necessarily see from Ryan and the House. And, you know, several GOP senators have been far more willing to call Trump out than the House has. Obviously, you've had John McCain, you've had Lindsey Graham, you've obviously had Burr agree to this probe. And when the Senate Intelligence Committee probe was first announced, there was even a threat to subpoena Trump administration officials and Obama administration officials. Whether those threats are carried through on obviously remains to be seen, but the fact that a lot of these inquiries are happening in the Senate, I think lends a little more credence, if only for the fact that Senate GOP members, though they're obviously the minority, have been more willing to stand up to Trump. And you've seen a more cogent anti-Russia line from GOP senators than you have in the House, for example. So where the Trump-Russia story goes, I'm not 100% sure, but I know that it won't go away, at least for the foreseeable future.
And Ali Watkins, is that something to do with what happened with the torture report? Because I remember talking to you at the time where the Democrats went ahead and printed their own version or put their own version out that was obviously redacted. And the full version is yet to see the light of day. But the Republicans didn't want to publish it, and the Democrats forced their hand and went ahead and published it. Is that leverage that the Democrats are exercising? Is Feinstein lighting a fire under Burr?
Well, actually, as far as the torture report or the Russia report?
Well, I'm saying the torture report has set a precedent. So, in other words, if Burr doesn't act honestly in terms of this Moscow report, or Russia report, the Democrats do have that precedent of having gone their own way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the most interesting thing to me about this Russia probe and the Senate Intelligence Committee is that Feinstein is no longer the ranking member on the panel. Mark Warner, senator from Virginia, has taken over the top Democratic spot on the intelligence panel. And Warner was never very outspoken. He didn't really have a intelligence shtick, if you will, on the committee. But I've heard from several sources that he's kind of stepped into his own with this Russia probe, and he's the one who really put Burr's feet to the fire on this. And has just kind of stepped into his role as leader of the committee on this issue. So it doesn't sound to me like Warner would let this be watered down without a very possibly public fight. So there is that precedent from the torture report of obviously both sides of the committee kind of fighting over things. And you've seen, I don't think anybody really expected it, but you've seen Warner kind of step into that Feinstein role as she was with the torture report to kind of, you know, shepherd this through.
Well, just in closing, Ali Watkins, what do you know about the Russia desk on the National Security Council itself? I understand that Sebastian Gorka, the Breitbart National Security Editor and a Fox News contributor, is expected to join the Trump White House National Security Council and on the Russia desk. Boris Epstein, who is a White House aide, a Russian-American, he's also been rumored to be on or being appointed to the NSC. Do they have a Russia desk? I mean, it seems to be considerable disarray.
I think disarray is probably the best word to describe the National Security Council at this point. I with the caveat that all of this is Washington rumor, a lot of smoke and mirrors around the National Security Council right now. The chatter around town is that Flynn is really driving a lot of the Russia policy. And I'm not 100% sure on staffing matters, but there's been chatter that Flynn has kind of picked some people to serve on the Russia desk at NSC. It's my understanding that there were some Obama holdovers on the NSC generally, but from what I've been able to tell, most, if not all, of the Obama-Russia hands on NSC were let go. So it looks like that's being completely restaffed with people who, from what I understand, the staffing has been heavily influenced by Flynn, who obviously has his own very controversial ties to Russia and RT. But as far as names go, outside of Gorka and Epstein, there has not been many clear personnel changes.
Well, Ally Watkins, I thank you for joining us from right outside the doors of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you learned something as they filter
you
out
and
of
both.
That. And thank you again for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
And again, I've been speaking with Ally Watkins, who's a D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News and previously covered national security for the Huffington Post and McClatchy Newspapers D.C. Bureau. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into reports that the number two job at the State Department will be going to neocon royalty Elliot Abrams.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual friend.
But one thing that is certain, life is good at Halliburton. How come you're so wrong, my sweet Leo?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jacob Halbron, who's a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at The New Republic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Halbron.
Thanks, Ian.
And the former State Department official, National Security Council official as well, Elliot Abrams, going back to the Reagan administration, actually, dare I say it, a convicted felon over the Iran-Contra issue. He was supposed to meet with Donald Trump today, and apparently the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, supports him in being his deputy, the number two person at the Department of State. So is that your understanding, that this position that many thought John Bolton was going to fill is actually going to be filled by an even more prominent neoconservative, Elliot Abrams?
Well, Elliot Abrams was said to be going in for the sniff test today. As you know, Trump invests great importance on both the stature and general appearance of his administration appointees. And perhaps the greatest thing in Elliot Abrams' favor is that he does not have the walrus mustache that John Bolton has, and which apparently prompted Trump to reject him as number two at the State Department.
So it's true then, is it, that Trump is unhappy with Sean Spicer because of the cut of his jib? He didn't like his suit, and now apparently he's incensed that a woman, Melissa McCarthy, was able to lampoon him?
Yes, apparently he felt that Spicer had been emasculated, so to speak, by Saturday Night Live. And I think he finds it unbearable that someone who's representing him publicly could be parodied by a woman. As you know, Trump's relations with women in general appear to be quite fraught. And it is interesting, Ian, that even his own wife remains ensconced in Trump Tower rather than living in Washington, D.C.
Well, there are all kinds of rumors that I've heard that she can't stand him and barely speaks to him, and they have problems with the child who has Asperger's, et cetera. So, that's an area that I don't really want to venture into. But a lot of people have discussed the body language of her in photographs, even at the charity ball over the weekend down in Florida, where it does seem like she's not having a good time, shall we say.
Well, back to Elliot Abrams. I didn't mean to navigate away from this topic. The blunt fact is that it is astounding that Trump would be contemplating the appointment of one of neocon royalty. He is the son-in-law of Norman Podoretz, and Podoretz is married to Midge Dekter, who's also a prominent neoconservative. So Elliot Abrams was a Democrat at Harvard, member of the Americans for Democratic Action. He went progressively to the right in the 1970s. He worked for both Henry Scoop Jackson and Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Moynihan moved to the center left during the Reagan administration. Abrams kept moving to the right and was an extremely controversial figure because his portfolios was human rights, and he was accused in the 80s of apologizing for the death squads in El Salvador, among other things. And as you noted earlier, he was a key player in the Iran-Contra scandal, which funneled weaponry to the Iranians and in exchange, it's a complicated scheme where the Sultan of Brunei then was supposed to funnel money and weapons to the Contras. This all became exposed and almost led to the demise of Reagan's presidency.
I know. I always wish that my bank account number was the one that they accidentally put in that bank's transfer of the Sultan of Brunei's. The money ended up in the wrong place. So not only...
And Abrams was also a key player in the George W. Bush administration on the National Security Council, where he was responsible for the Middle East. One thing we should note is that he is a vehemently pro-Israel in the Netanyahu camp. And as you alluded earlier, Jared Kushner, who is Trump's son-in-law, another son-in-law in this mix, is firmly in the Netanyahu camp as well. So the speculation is that Kushner is pushing for Abrams. Steve Bannon has been vetting Abrams and is suspicious of him, but there is an overlap since they both are extremely hostile to the Islamic world.
And again, I'm speaking with Jacob Harbron, who's a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously was an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at The New Republic. Well, the one thing they have in common is not just the Islamic world, because they're very selective. You know, the Muslim ban is against seven countries, none of which have exported terrorists to the United States, whereas the main exporters of terrorism to the United States, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and Afghanistan, are not even on the list. But nevertheless, they, in their zeal against Islam, they're going after the Iranians more than anything. And that is pretty hard to understand, particularly when you got Elliot Abrams. I mean, how much evidence do you need that if you meddle with Iran, you get burned? Have they not noticed what happened to the presidency of Jimmy Carter? Did they not notice how Iran-Contra almost brought down Ronald Reagan?
Well, I think we are on the path towards war with Iran, and not a small war. But it would have to be a massive assault, and it would have to be coordinated with Israel. If you look at the comments of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn saying that Iran is on notice, Trump's bellicose language, You insert Abrams in there. You have James Mattis at the Defense Department. It does have the feeling of the second Bush administration. And I think these guys may well be intent on provoking a conflict.
Well, I mean, obviously, Cheney also wanted to go after them as well. But I don't understand. I mean, if you do anything against Iran, the country will rise up and unite around the flag. That happens with all countries. Patriotism, rallying around the flag when you're under attack. And any ideas that they've heard, these ideas that you can somehow surgically take out the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and then suddenly the whole country is going to celebrate, just as the neocons had fantasies of Iraqis throwing flowers on the tanks of the American liberators. Is that what they're thinking, that somehow you can decapitate this terrible government? And it's no question that these crazies are terrible, but there's a symbiotic relationship between IRGC, the hawks, and the supreme leader, and these neocons and right-wing nutballs like Bannon and company in the White House. You know, the IRGC hates the nuclear deal as much as Bannon and Trump and Elliot Abrams.
Well, you have to hope that it doesn't come to war, but there certainly the scales seem to be weighted towards some kind of a conflict with Iran. I don't know exactly what they're envisioning. You know, they've only been in office for a couple of weeks, but the language is so stark that it certainly seems like they are intent on provoking some kind of bellicosities with Iran. And as you pointed out, it would boomerang. Most of the Iran's population is predominantly youthful, under 30, and pro-American, or at least thinks highly of American culture. And I think it would be an act of insanity to attack them willfully.
So the one person that seems to be a bit of a roadblock, and I don't know what one senator alone can do in trying to stop this impending appointment of Elliot Abrams as the number two at the State Department, is, of course, Senator Rand Paul. Now, is this a 60-vote situation? And what's the confirmation protocol here?
Yeah, I mean, Paul could stymie it. I don't know how long he would be prepared to do that. Tremendous pressure would be brought on him. But it is a sign of the divisions in the Republican Party itself, since, weirdly enough, appointing Abrams would actually endear Trump to the hawkish wing of the Republican Party. Lindsey Graham and John McCain would be elated by his appointment.
So I'm reminded of John McCain singing bomb, 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 Moran. So he's already had a long obsession with it. So you think there's a critical mass there? You've got Mattis, apparently, has also got a bug about Iran. You've got Bannon. You got, by the way, Bannon's friend, Eric Prince, who has a private army there in the Gulf in the UAE, has the means by which to create an incident that could be a spark for a war, because it wouldn't take much with those IRGC speedboats running around the Gulf in the Straits of Hormuz to fabricate an incident. And then you've got Elliot Abrahams, and you've got Netanyahu there, who's already got his guy there right next to Trump. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. So it seems like the constellation is arrayed in that way to make war with Iran look like more than a possibility, but a probability. Is that how you interpret it?
Yeah, I guess the question is when they would do it, because, I mean, he would utterly scotch his domestic program if he ventured into war with Iran right now. The question is when. Does he do it before during the re-election campaign?
Well, I think his days are numbered, because he's so out of his depth. He's so unstable every day. I, you know, just last night I was watching CBS Evening News, and the lead stories, if you were a visitor from Mars, you'd think, my God, how did this guy ever get into the White House? It's the most insane stuff of you know, telling the soldiers at CENTCOM that the press is not covering terrorist incidents. I mean, the problem with the terrorism is that the press covers it too much. That's why these guys are motivated to do it, because it makes them immortal and they grab the headlines. You know, some hapless idiot can pull off a stunt and the press will cover it for weeks on end. So, and I mean, this is the crazy part, that I don't see how this guy can last very long. And on top of that, you got the Russian investigation that's out there, even though...
But who would boot Trump out? I mean, all these congressional Republicans are quaking before him because they don't want a primary challenge.
Or a tweet storm. Yeah. Well, I think hasn't he delivered what they want? They've got the power they want. They've got a Koch brothers cabinet. They're moving their agenda as fast as they can. They've got the House and the Senate. So how much do they need him?
You know, he is trying to reinvent the Republican Party into an ethno-national base, and I think that's Bannon's agenda. So I think the House Republicans do have to proceed warily. I think Trump can rally the base in a way that they can't.
Well, but if he, just that aside, if this smoking gun about Russia, and it's pretty extraordinary, some of the stuff that's starting to come out about the CIA losing all of its top spies in Moscow who apparently tipped off. The assumption is that it wasn't the CIA or the FBI. There's no moles. It's likely to be coincided with when the Trump administration got its intelligence briefings on Russia. Suddenly, America loses all of its spies, including top generals in the FSB. One was murdered on Boxing Day. Others have been arrested in very dramatic forms of having bags over their head and pulled out of high-level meetings. That kind of stuff's going on. So let's just assume that at some point or other, Trump can't cover up the real smoking gun, that he might well be put on trial for treason. That'd be a good time to start a war, to take the headlines away. I mean, Reagan did it after the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut. That was a terrible story. They didn't know what to do. They had 240 dead Marines. Obviously, they were going to start investigating the incredible incompetence that led to that massacre of Marines. And then a couple of days later, they invade Grenada. And the whole story goes away. So it's not like it hasn't happened before.
That's true. Well, I don't know. You know, a lot of this depends. Let's see what happens with the Elliott Abrams nomination, whether Trump even signs off on it.
Well,
Abrams repeatedly criticized Trump during the campaign.
It's true, and Abrams doesn't look like a matinee idol. Apparently, if how you look on TV is a prerequisite, then I don't know. There aren't too many Republican Cary Grants out there, as far as I can tell. So, how much does that count against him? As apart from the baggage, it seems like. If he's got Bannon, I mean, Bannon apparently has a lot of sway over Kushner. Kushner seems to be under the sway of Netanyahu. So I imagine if Abrams gets the job, he gets Bannon's nod, right? Wouldn't that make sense?
Yeah. Well, we're in, you know, ever since Trump was elected, we are in utterly uncharted waters. It is extraordinary that Trump would appoint someone who epitomizes everything that he campaigned against.
Right, but he's already forgotten everything. I mean, it's extraordinary to think that his supporters haven't noticed that they've been conned. I mean, the first thing he signed was an executive order making it more difficult for working Americans to get mortgages and making it more expensive. This is the champion of the working class. I mean, everything he's done with all these billionaires and with Betsy DeVos now has been to enable the billionaires, and then he's going to give them all a massive tax cut. I just don't know what you can do about that. You know, it seems like Trump's followers have to figure out eventually how flagrantly they've been betrayed.
Well, the foreign policy will only become a big issue if something actually occurs abroad that's disastrous, which it well could.
So, but how does that relate to the domestic issue of the con job? How do you keep Trump supporters in line as he does everything to betray all of his promises?
He just keeps attacking liberals.
And the press.
Yeah.
Who are the only people that can hold him accountable now that Bannon has said the real opposition is the press, not the Democrats.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, I don't mean to make light of this situation, but so many people call me up and they're almost suicidal about what's happening to this country. And that's not a particularly...
Well, the interesting thing is, Ian, though, that what has Trump actually accomplished? He signed a bunch of executive orders, but now let's see what happens with the travel ban. He hasn't actually gotten any legislation passed. They're not able to repeal Obamacare. I think that their own incompetence may prove their undoing.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Jacob Halpern.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jacob Halpern, who's a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. And previously, he was an editorial writer for The Los Angeles Times and a senior editor at The New Republic. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the recent U.S. raid in Yemen that the Trump White House is claiming as a great success. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Sheila Carapico, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, where she researches the political economy of development with a special emphasis on Arab countries. And recently, she was a professor in the political science department at the American University in Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia, and her latest book is Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf, and she's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sheila Carapico.
Always great to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Sheila. And one of your areas of expertise for some time has been Yemen, a country that is the poorest in the Arab world. It's been under civil war and a war prosecuted by Saudi Arabia. The Obama administration kind of kept a low profile. They used a lot of drone attacks, but basically let Saudi Arabia take the lead. But now the first military action of the Trump administration has been extremely loud and rather clumsy. And what's so frankly amazing about it is that this Yemen raid that they've touted as a huge success looks like a complete debacle. And had it happened under Obama's watch, it would almost, the Republicans would be screaming from the rafters since they made up a whole case about Benghazi. Jimmy Carter, of course, was humiliated by what happened in Iran. So let's start with that apparent double standard. Do you see a double standard here?
Well, I mean, certainly on the part of the Republicans and you referred to Benghazi in particular, the kind of steady drumbeat of how Clinton lost an ambassador and so forth in the midst of a very chaotic situation in Libya. What we have here is this kind of one-off where, among the shocking things, the only Yemeni that we really reliably can report has been killed is an 8-year-old girl. We lost an American SEAL. and an Apache helicopter. So it certainly looks like a botched operation. But it's difficult to know exactly what went into it. I mean, you said, and I'm not arguing that Obama kept a low profile, but, you know, the irony is that we've been backing the Saudi-led, the United States has been backing the Saudi-led operation in Yemen, which is against the enemies of Al-Qaeda. So, you know, there's a way in which for quite some time the United States has been pursuing a policy in Yemen that is very much counter to the stated goals of defeating Al-Qaeda.
I think actually they I don't know whether they lost an Apache, but I believe they lost the vertical takeoff plane called the Osprey, which is an extremely expensive platform, and it cost about $75 million, and it was destroyed by a Harrier jet, a bomb from a Harrier jet, in order to destroy the evidence, if you will,
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. I'm really not good on my different kinds of aircraft, and you're absolutely correct. It's an Osprey, not an Apache.
So let's talk then about the raid itself and the speculation that it was pushed forward. There's a lot of apparently dissent from the CIA. Pompeo even threatened to resign. He was cut out of the loop. It was largely pushed by Mattis, and it didn't go through the normal channels on the National Security Council. Again, leads you to this suspicion that the kind of eminence gris, the Rasputin of the Trump administration, Stephen Bannon, pushed this raid that the Pentagon wasn't ready for. And then when it blew up in their face, they said, oh, which was something that Obama had planned. So what do you understand about the behind-the-scenes intramural battles that are going on here over this raid that clearly they weren't, the intelligence wasn't good, and it was apparently pushed forward for political reasons?
You know, I am prepared to believe that the U.S. military would have been much more cautious with this than the operation inclined, and therefore I'm also, you know, prepared to believe that this was kind of pushed through politically rather than a carefully planned military operation. I mean, it's also very unusual. I mean, one of the striking things about this is that the United States has been quite actively involved in Yemen, of course, for quite some time. I mean, the little girl who was killed, her father was killed in a drone strike, her brother was killed in a drone strike. And, you know, the Obama administration used drone strikes, you know, fairly frequently. But what was unusual about this one is the boots on the ground. I mean, maybe not large numbers, but that's actually quite an unusual event for Yemen. And we would hope as American citizens that extraordinary care would be taken before putting, you know, American personnel in harm's way. And given the outcome, we just are not inclined to conclude that extraordinary care was taken.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sheila Carapico, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. She was a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And her latest book is Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. And she's a contributing editor to Middle East Report. So let's talk about how this went down in the Yemen itself. The government, which is ostensibly we're on its side and it's siding with the Saudis, although there's intramural battles going on there within that government itself. And then you've got the Houthi rebels who often referred to as an Iran proxy, although that's usually exaggerated. The one piece of information that's come out from is the AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula leader, Qasim al-Rimi, has made a statement. He was allegedly the object of the raid, even though he wasn't there. And the best thing that the military said is that after the Harrier jets bombed the building that from which they were they were being shot at from, that they came in, dragged the bodies out, and found a bunch of laptops, which had apparently already been bombed. And then, of course, the Pentagon put out a film to show how valuable the intelligence was, and it turned out that this Al-Qaeda training video that they put out was at least a decade old and was available online. So they've had to pull that as well. So let's start with the AQAP leader. Do you think he was the target?
You know, I mean, that claim is made, but it's not very strong. I mean, and also I don't think that the claim that he is the leader as opposed to kind of an operational character has necessarily been verified. And then, as you say, I mean, the other parts of it, you know, the out-of-date video, the laptops and so forth, I mean, just bring us back to, I think, you know, the same thing that I said and you're implying in your further questioning, which is, you know, there's very little evidence of the kind of care and planning that ought to go into this kind of operation. And then, you know, the kind of failure to identify, okay, who exactly was killed. There was a denial that there were women and children, but then, you know, there was photographic evidence provided by eyewitnesses, people on the spot, that showed that that was the case. The latest we've heard, I believe, is that there were 12 Al-Qaeda fighters among the dead. I think those of us who watch these kind of things carefully would really like to see their names.
Well, is it possible that this attack, you know, which seemed to be politically motivated in pushing it forward, and clearly there wasn't sufficient planning, and they tried to blame it on the Obama administration, and apparently the Obama administration, a number of people, Colin Carle and others, and the deputy CIA woman just was on TV today saying no, this was never a planned raid. There was nowhere near that. So if this was pushed for political purposes to take maybe negative headlines off the TV screens, is it possible that it also had something to do with the ships that the Houthis have sunk and damaged off the coast, this naval blockade that's underway, a literal ship that was leased from the U.S. Navy, one of those brand new big trimaran weird-looking ships that was blown up by a Houthi cruise missile a while back, and it was leased to the UAE, and then I believe a Saudi, was it a frigate or a gunboat, was also hit by, I think it might have been a suicide attack just only a few days ago. So is that what's going on, that they're taking a bit of a beating there, the fleet?
I think that's very plausible. I mean, clearly we've heard about those operations, and each one of them is a little bit murky. I mean, I've seen a lot of analysis of exactly what kind of operation it was that hit the Saudi, and I'm just going to say ship, and there are probably, or at least there's noise or rumors of some other things going on. So I think your suggestion that one, because otherwise you wonder, like, okay, why be hasty with something like this? But the notion that it might divert attention from other things going on in the region does make some sense. Although, again, it's a little bit contrary to the dominant narrative, because most of the narrative is, okay, the Houthis are attacking the Americans and the Saudis and the so-called, what the Saudis consider to be the legitimate Yemeni government, and, of course, the United Arab Emirates, who, by the way, also had people on the ground here in Al Bayda. But so it also kind of scrambles the message, because the message from the naval incident is the Houthis are attacking the Saudis. In this case, then, the United States is going against Al-Qaeda. Maybe they're trying to refocus attention on, you know, what they maybe consider to be the more important fight. But there's something very kind of murky about all of this, I must say.
So, but the Houthis, in spite of the enormous amount of money and assets that the Saudis are pouring in there, it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And this army of Houthis, these guys running around in sandals, seem to have really been quite effective in these naval operations, basically destroying two big warships. is pretty impressive, isn't it? And everybody keeps saying it's all being directed and financed by Iran. Obviously, they're getting weapons from somewhere, and there's a naval blockade, which is where these ships were under attack in conducting this blockade. So what's your understanding just in the last couple of minutes about the role of Iran? It's, you know, obviously, our previous guest on today's program and others have suggested that this administration seems bent on sort of trying to either start a war with Iran or spark an incident to create a war. And we already know that General Flynn, the NSC director, the NSC advisor, has put Iran on notice, whatever that means.
Well, that was exactly the point that I was making a minute ago about it being kind of odd, given all the drumbeat against Iran, to suddenly kind of and hastily arrange an operation against al-Qaeda, which is at cross purposes with the fight against Iran. In response to the question of Iranian weapons, that really has not been proven. In other words, we haven't seen photographic evidence. And the Houthis, clearly their main arsenal comes from the deposed president, who are there now in alliance with, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who, you know, kept most of the military equipment that his regime had had all along. And, you know, it's not as if the Houthis are flying aircraft or significant naval vessels or, you know, large-scale munitions. You know, they're fighting with shoulder-held weapons and, you know, armored vehicles and, you know, some tanks perhaps, but most of the weapons that the Houthis are using, I think most military expert that I really know about sees those as things that were already in Yemen.
But just in the last minute, do you think that there is something brewing there in terms of a conflict with Iran? That and Yemen might well be, they're getting blamed for it already, right?
You know, I would expect that. It wouldn't surprise me at all, given the rhetoric coming from the new administration. But this operation is a little bit at odds with that.
Sure. Well, Sheila Karapiko, I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, great. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapiko, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. She was a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University in Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And her latest book is Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. And she's a contributing editor to Middle East Report. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes Podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.